Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, where Michael Kirby makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. He's been a speaker here in the past and a supporter of long-standing. Now, he's well known to all of you, but I will introduce him briefly. His Honour Michael Kirby is a former Justice of the High Court of Australia. Between 2013 and 2014, he chaired the United Nations Commission on Human Rights Violations in North Korea. And tonight he's speaking on the topic of North Korea beyond the tragedy of Otto Warmbier. The Honourable Michael Kirby, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jared, and it's very nice to be here in the new premises, up in the clouds, but with feet firmly planted on the ground. And that is, in a sense, the text for what I'm going to talk about tonight. In the clouds of our minds and our hearts, and also of the law of the Charter of the United Nations on Human Rights, but with our feet firmly planted on the ground in the serious situation that is presented to the world, and in particularly to the neighbours of DPRK, the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, North Korea, particularly presented to its neighbours. And I acknowledge the presence here tonight of the Consul General of Japan and consuls, Deputy Consul General of Japan, who are here, and perhaps other diplomatic representatives. This week, the family of Otto Warmbier announced in their polite and understated American way, "It is our sad duty to report that our son has completed his journey home. Otto died today at 2 o'clock. The apparently healthy, well-nourished, popular American university student from Wyoming, Ohio, made a fateful decision in China at the end of 2015. Instead of returning directly to his economic studies at the University of Virginia, he signed up for a short trip to the Hermit Kingdom. His idea was to spend the New Year break in North Korea. During his stay at a Pyongyang hotel, he entered the staff room, which was off bounds. He removed a propaganda banner, or was it a poster, that lauded the achievements of the Korean Workers' Party and proclaimed undying loyalty to the great leader, Kim Jong-un. This act, doubtless conceived of as a cheeky gesture, the kind of thing many a young Australian might do overseas, was not perceived as harmless by the North Korean authorities. The young Otto was arrested and separated from his group, who left for home. He began his journey into grossly excessive punishment. He was tried and obliged to tender abject apologies. He was sentenced to 15 years hard labour. He joined other, mostly American, prisoners from the West, whose extreme punishments were probably designed to serve as inducements to procure outlandish concessions and to signify humiliation and submission. During 18 months of detention, something undefined happened that plunged Otto into an unresponsive coma. A deal was struck last week to return the comatose prisoner to his family. Wyoming, Ohio welcomed him back, but he died without recovering responsiveness. Otto Warmbier was foolish in the way that young people can sometimes be. But his jailers were brutal, secretive, and neglectful. His punishment was totally disproportionate. Proportion and moderation are features of universal human rights and of democratic polities. They are not features of the society of North Korea that the young Otto had offhandedly decided to visit as a New Year lark. The United Kingdom tour company has now cancelled tours for Americans to North Korea. The family condemn what they see as the wrong done to their son by North Korea. The world looks on and tries to draw its conclusions. In May 2013, as members of the Sydney Institute know from earlier talks I've given on the subject, I was appointed to chair a United Nations Commission of Inquiry on Democratic People's Republic of Korea and the violations against human rights in that country. This is the report of the Commission of Inquiry. The United Nations, quite efficient in organising inquiries of this kind, is not so efficient in getting the reports published in the way that will reach out and be available at every airport to bring the word home. I hope that one day I will find an extremely wealthy philanthropist at an event such as this who will say this report should be in the hands of people everywhere in the world. It is readable. Unlike many reports of the United Nations, it is readable. I took pains over every word in the report. Now, nothing in my 35 years as a judge in Australia had prepared me for the, quote, systematic, widespread and gross human rights violations that were disclosed in the evidence about the conditions in North Korea. We were denied entry by the regime. We never expected that they would submit themselves to our close inspection. However, we had no problems whatever in gathering reliable and convincing evidence. Apart from everything else, there are more than 30,000 North Korean refugees now living in South Korea, where they have a constitutional right to citizenship. In understated public testimony before the Commission, available now online, many of these refugees came forward to tell the horror story of what is going on in that country. North Korea is a land of ceaseless propaganda, of torture and inhuman treatment, of arbitrary arrest and detention, of public execution to which schoolchildren are brought to look and to learn what happens to enemies of the state. Detention camps exist, where family members must join the accused so as to rid society entirely of the risks of contagion. It is a place where freedom of movement is strictly controlled. It is a place where Korean, Japanese, and other nationals have been abducted to serve the purposes of the Kim dynasty, where starvation of thousands is a recurring nightmare because of the failures of the economic system, a leftover of the world's last truly Stalinist society. North Korea rejects the evidence and findings of the UN inquiry about the gulags, which house what they call the hostile class. Yet they reject UN demands to permit inspectors to examine the places that we, from our inquiry, can identify precisely from the description of the witnesses. satellite images confirm the testimony provided to us by our witnesses. In today's world, you see, it is less easy than once it was to hide widespread wrongdoing. After the UN report was delivered to the Human Rights Council in March 2014, it was impossible to deny with any conviction the serious state of affairs in North Korea. According to our findings, quote, "The gravity, scale, and nature of these violations reveal a state that does not have any parallel in the contemporary world. It is, quote, a totalitarian state, a state that does not content itself with ensuring the authoritarian rule of a small group of people, but seeks to dominate every aspect of its citizens' lives and terrorizes them from within." The young Otto Warmbier had been specifically told by the tour company that he should not go into the staff quarters in his hotel. He'd been warned of the hypersensitivity of the North Korean leadership to slights and to challenges to their leadership. Perhaps, as in his own country, that was just the challenge that was needed to make his sudden gesture to pilfer the propaganda symbol. But North Korea is a pitiless place, especially so for an uppity, well-fed, boisterous American tourist. What he was not counting on was the pervasiveness of surveillance and the subordination of elite hotel employees to loyalty to the great leader. Young Otto didn't suffer detention in the political camps. His fate was incarceration in the ordinary prison system of the country. If before setting out for Pyongyang, he had had the opportunity to read the report of the UN Commission on North Korea, he would have learned of our specific findings on grossly inhumane acts committed there against ordinary prisoners, of extermination and murder, of torture, rape, and other grave sexual violence happening in the prisons, of conditions similar to enslavement, which persist behind the prison walls, of shocking shortages of food and hygiene that during the Great Famine of the mid-1990s led to emaciating bodies being collected every morning, put in a wheelbarrow, wheeled to a vat, and reduced to ashes, and with extremities of the human body not decomposing so quickly, the ashes and the extremities were scattered in the nearby field to fertilise for the purpose of the food for the prisoners, meagre though it was. The crimes against humanity that are recorded in the report are a feature of daily life in North Korea, and you can imagine they're special in the prisons of North Korea. Had he read our report, he might have thought twice about going to such a country to celebrate New Year 2016. And if he had gone, he would have been aware of the brutality that attends even trivial infractions, especially by foreigners and particularly by Americans. But he was just a high-spirited student with his whole life ahead of him. Suddenly, by an act which he would have regarded almost certainly as relatively harmless, he became a dispensable pawn in a great international chess game. A seemingly minor player in the geopolitical chessboard, North Korea, has suddenly aspired to be a king. Despite comparative poverty and disadvantage, it has developed nuclear warheads. It has tested sophisticated missiles. It has experimented with submarine launching facilities that will allow it to threaten more than its neighbours. The established players in the game do not seem to know how to declare checkmate to this new would-be king. A tiny pawn like Otto Wambier can quite easily be removed from the game and even from life. When and how the young Otto's brain damage first occurred may never be known. Like so much else about North Korea, it's shrouded in obsessive secrecy and mystery. Perhaps this is what intrigued Otto and caused him to take his fateful decision to go there. So how should we remember Otto Wambier from Ohio? His plight should draw our attention to an entire people subjected in North Korea to daily acts of formidable disproportion and violence. Accidentally, perhaps, Otto's incarceration, coma, removal and death, once again, called to notice the sufferings of the other prisoners languishing in the jails of North Korea. A young American's fate becomes a metaphor, a kind of symbol of a big story about thousands of nameless human beings with mothers and lovers and children and memories, now statistics who are locked up and oppressed in North Korea. They are voiceless, but Otto Wambier speaks of their suffering from his grave. He reminds the world of the human rights wrongs in North Korea, and he joins the voices of the many witnesses who gave testimony to the UN Commission, collected on every page of this book. The young Otto never woke from his coma to tell of his ordeal. Still, the image of his healthy, strapping American student joyfully speaking at his high school graduation on YouTube, where you can see him, is a reminder of all the other human victims who remain behind. They are locked up in their prisons, their detention camps and elsewhere behind the demilitarized zone in a closed society that is North Korea. They will remain locked up in that silence until the United Nations and the world community respond effectively to the United Nations report. In 1945, in the United Nations Charter and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and soon afterwards at Nuremberg and at the trials elsewhere in the Pacific, the world promised that never again would it turn away from crimes against humanity. Never again would it turn away from crimes against humanity. That promise has not yet been delivered. We owe it to Otto Wambier, but also to the people of North Korea who still live in the shadows, to deliver on the promise. The development of nuclear weapons in North Korea makes fidelity to the promise more difficult. That is true. But it also makes it more important and more urgent. The boy from Wyoming, Ohio, tells the world. It tells us here at the Sydney Institute tonight in peaceful Australia. It tells us here that this is an urgent challenge and that we should act. But will we act? Can we act? This is the puzzle that is left to the international community by the life and death of Otto Wambier. I gave a talk last night, not on Wambier, at least I intervened in a talk by others at the Australian Institute of International Affairs. There were two very distinguished others, one a judge and an author, and another a very experienced diplomat. And in their description of the situation in North Korea, they did not find it necessary to refer to human rights. Naturally, I rose at the end of their presentation and I asked, why? Why was there no mention of human rights? The answer was, because human rights will merely make it more complicated and difficult to solve the geopolitical strategic problems of North Korea. But that is the exact opposite of what the world said it would do henceforth in relation to crimes against humanity. We are not talking here about human rights violations. There are human rights violations in every country. There are human rights violations in our country, Australia. But we're talking about crimes against humanity, which mean crimes of great violence leading to widespread death that shock the conscience of humankind. And so the challenge before us is, how do we address the promise of the Charter, where universal human rights is the first of the objectives of the new organisation, in the preamble to the Charter of the United Nations? How do we answer the obligations that we say we have accepted, whilst at the same time addressing the peril of nuclear weapons, which are themselves very great challenges to human rights? If you potentially kill or threaten huge numbers of people with death by nuclear weapons, then that is itself a very serious affront to universal human rights. And so that, I suggest, is the issue that we have to address our minds to tonight at the Sydney Institute. How are we faithful to the promise of the Charter and to the experience of the Second World War and the terrible things that happened then and have happened since? And at the same time, how do we assure the human rights of people like Otto Warmbier and the other people behind the demilitarised zone in Korea? For the first time in my life, I have finished in shorter than the time that is allocated to me. I'm terrified of Jared. He kept talking about make it short so that you can give time to the members and visitors to the Sydney Institute so that they can ask questions and make comments and disagree and dissent, something he said that I was rather well known for postulating and practicing. So that is what I've come to say. We will have a big round of applause, a big round of applause, and then Q&A.
I suspect that Michael Kirby's been too influenced by his time inquiring into the events of North Korea. It's not customary here for the speaker to call for a warm applause. So it's set a new principle. Yeah. So many thanks. Look, it's a sad occasion tonight, but a very important occasion, and it's couldn't think of any more appropriate in the world to talk about this topic here tonight because of the important work that was done on the inquiry, the Commission Inquiry on Human Rights into the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, which is remarkable because it is so well written. So we're coming to the question discussion. We've got to the top of the hour. Let's start off briefly with your thoughts about South Korea. You mentioned North Korea's threat of nuclear weapons. You mentioned development of missiles. You mentioned the development of submarines. But as you know from your time in South Korea, there's also this great threat to South Korea from conventional artillery on the border not far from Seoul, which could destroy Seoul by conventional weapons, as in a sense, I suppose, Seoul was destroyed during the Korean War 6 decades ago. So when you talk about these matters in South Korea, what do the leadership in and others, people in South Korea, say about their concern about how they respond to that particular domestic threat, which goes beyond, which is part of the general international threat?
Well, South Korean citizens divide in their response to the issues of North Korea. That division was seen in the recent election. What a difference was there between North Korea and South Korea. the president, Park Geun-hye, who had been elected and defeated the candidate of the opposition, Mr. Moon Jae-in, was suspected of corruption. There were demonstrations in the streets that North Korea showed in its media as a signal of how discontented people were in South Korea. That is something that might come back to bite them, because the signal, the sign of people free to demonstrate their views on the streets was such a difference from the society in North Korea. In South Korea, there has been for decades a stream of opinion, of which President Moon has been an exponent. The stream of opinion says that confronting North Korea and insisting on the human rights situation is not going to get us anywhere. And in all truth, the policy of confrontation hasn't had a great deal of impact on North Korea. So there are differences in the views, and this is one of the developments. I mean, if we look at the developments that have happened since the report of the Commission of Inquiry, they include the change of administration in South Korea, the change of administration in the United States of America, the moves that are occurring in many democratic countries of disillusionment and populist politics, and how these factors will play in the context of the other big development that has happened, which is the conduct of five tests of nuclear weapons, of the development of missiles that are of increasing sophistication, and remarkable progress appears to have been made in a very short time with those missiles. And so these are the change factors that have happened. But I think if one looks at the recent statements of President Moon, he started office with a very strong statement of outreach to North Korea. He's had no positive response whatever, and his more recent statements appear to reflect that fact. And I think it's going to be very difficult to get a positive response voluntarily by North Korea. But what one then does is the challenge that is before us, and that's what I want us to concentrate on.
Question up the back.
Judge, a lot of the commentary in sort of diplomatic circles and also the media about the way change or moderation of behaviour in North Korea is going to be brought about centres upon the role of the People's Republic of China, Hong, I think the strongest supporter of the regime in North Korea. What do you think about that, given the obvious irony in terms of that country's human rights record? And is it the best hope that we have to see their behaviour, the North Korean behaviour, change?
Well, I think I've foreshadowed what I think about it. I mean, what I think about it doesn't matter. My mandate for the United Nations has concluded, and my mandate never included geopolitical defence matters and issues of military kind and activities in the Security Council of the United Nations. My work was in the for the Human Rights Council, which reports to the General Assembly, and that's what we did. But if I look candidly at the follow-up to the report, the UN did everything it could do in the organs of the General Assembly and of the Human Rights Council. In the Human Rights Council, it established, through the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, a field office in Seoul, which has continued to interview witnesses and to take records of the statements which one day would be available for a prosecution or prosecutions if that can be organised. So that was done. It has conducted universal periodic review of the situation in North Korea, which North Korea refused to cooperate, but has now begun partly to cooperate with. But the central recommendation we made was one that only the Security Council could deliver, and that was that the Security Council should refer the case of North Korea to a prosecutor of the International Criminal Court. If this were an entirely rational world in which great power did not intervene in such matters, that is what would happen. There is plenty of evidence of terrible crimes that needs to be investigated. Justice, which is one of the core principles of the United Nations and universal human rights, demands and suggests that something should be done, but it's not being done. No vote has yet been taken in the Security Council. Inferentially, that's because it is felt that one and possibly two of the permanent five members would not vote in favour of this action. But, you know, it's a strange thing when you're in the bottom of 42nd Street and you're in that big building and you go into that beautiful room, which is the Security Council room, and you see that table with the horseshoe shape and the 15 places for 15 human beings that sit there. There's something about propinquity and human beings' common fears and dangers that can sometimes achieve results that you wouldn't logically have thought will happen. For example, the increase, the substantial increase in the sanctions on North Korea that have followed the nuclear weapons tests is an indication that required the vote. That was a substantive matter and required the vote, including the concurrence of the five permanent members, which they gave. So I'm not setting aside the possibility that something will ultimately happen because of the concerns of all of the countries about not only the case of North Korea, but what North Korea symbolises. If we cannot deal with the challenge to non-proliferation of North Korea, we cannot deal with it in the next country that challenges the principle of the non-proliferation treaty. And therefore, this is, in a sense, a moment of truth. And it's a moment of truth not just for the United Nations system. It's a moment of truth for the human species, because the huge numbers of nuclear weapons and the stockpiles of especially the Russian Federation and the United States of America are many times more than enough to destroy the whole of this world and all of us and all of the human species and all the beauties that we have created. So this is a tremendously important existential question, and I'm not putting out of my mind the fact that when the crunch comes, that the Security Council in that beautiful room will make wise decisions. Doesn't always, but this is truly existential.
There's a question there, and then there's a question there, and then a question here. Jeff? Yep.
Michael, a wonderful talk, beautifully delivered. Perhaps the Sydney Institute might publish the book. But when you talk about the inquiry, you talk about the evidence. What was the test you used in relation to assess the evidence? Because there was North Korea to dissipate. I mean, there was no contradictor. How was it that you were able to make the findings of evidence in the way, I assume you don't have, if I haven't not read the book, but I mean, what was the test, or how was that done when there was no one there to give evidence opposing what anyone particularly had said? The other second question I've got to cut off that is, how did the people who gave evidence escape from North Korea? How did they do that?
Well, first of all, on the second question, most of them escaped when it was easier to escape. They escaped across the rivers in the north of North Korea, separating North Korea from the People's Republic of China, by walking across the frozen rivers in the winter. That was a reasonably easy thing to do for a long time. Kim Jong-il sent his son and heir apparent, Kim Jong-un, up to inspect this drain of people, nationals. And Kim Jong-un came back with the report that it was easy to escape the fatherland. And that led first to the building of new and more impenetrable fences along the border, and secondly to the negotiation of a protocol with the People's Republic of China, which is referred to in this report, whereby people who are caught in China would be automatically sent back. We had to tell China that that was contrary to China's obligations under the Refugees Convention and Protocol. They rejected that. They said, these are not refugees, these are merely economic migrants. As I had heard that argument in another place, it didn't particularly impress me, and we had to tell them that under international human rights law, even if you've come to a country as an economic migrant and you then find that being sent back, you will be subjected to a well-founded fear of persecution, then you are what's called a refugee surplus. The exchange between the ambassador for China and the Commission of Inquiries in this report, it bears reading. It's very interesting. It's just a difference of view. But it's harder to escape now, and the numbers of refugees, in South Korea they call them defectors, but that has postulates to it, so I just call them refugees. The numbers of refugees has significantly dropped. I don't think that's because people are living and loving more happily in North Korea. It's because it's harder. As to the test that we applied, it's all explained in the report, as you would expect with a lawyer like me writing it. It's explained at the outset. We applied the test that is common in United Nations inquiries. We were not a court. We were not a tribunal. We were not a prosecutor. We were the step anterior to that. We were an inquirer. And the test for us was on a balance of probability, a reasonable probability that the facts were true. But more than that, we did something very unusual, never been done really before by a UN Commission of Inquiry. We did the inquiry, as I explained once before when I came to this institute, in the Anglo-American Australian way. We sat in public. We had public hearings. We invited the media. We filmed the testimony where it was safe to do so. We checked whether they had relatives back in North Korea, in which event we either disguised them or their some of the details, or we saw them privately. But we saw plenty of them, and you can see them, not in North Korea, where the only the elite get access to the internet, but in other countries of the world, virtually every other country, you can Google United Nations Commission of Inquiry, North Korea. You can sit there for days looking at this testimony. And, of course, that was our answer to North Korea when they said, these are enemies of the fatherland, self-selected haters of our glorious leader. We said, if you don't believe the commission, have a look yourself. You can sit there and judge for yourself. And so that's what we did, and that's what we said. As to the dangers, we were very careful about that. Our obligation was first do no harm, and we were careful not to imperil the lives of the witnesses. And when we went to Japan and we saw members of the families of the abductees who were brutally seized on the streets of Japan, even a school child on her way home from badminton practice, and taken to North Korea for trivial purposes of the regime, and admitted by Kim Jong-il, admitted. We were very careful in identifying families, and of course in Japan there's a very deep feeling about this, and rightly so, and there are many Korean escapees who were seized and taken there too.
There's a question there and then here. Yeah.
Yes, I'm sort of concerned concerned...
Speak up, please. I can't hear.
I'm concerned about the snail pace of the geopolitical thing, and I'm speaking about...
You have to translate this.
And I'm speaking about this from the point of view of having a daughter and grandchildren living in Seoul married to a New Zealand diplomat. So which way do you think things will really go? Because I don't think the United Nations has a great track record for moving rapidly in any...
So the question has got relatives living in Seoul and is concerned about what he calls the snail pace of what's happening here in relation to the human rights issues.
Well, that's a fair concern. I share the concern. On the other hand, the dangers of the nuclear weapons. It's reported that they have 20 nuclear warheads. That's a lot of firepower. And every test of the five tests, the kiloton explosive capacity has gone up exponentially. It's in an exponential graph. But as Jared Henderson pointed out, leave aside nuclear weapons, which may have particular connotations. Just use ordinary firepower. North Korea has the third largest standing army in the world. This is for a country with a population of 24 million. It's got the same population as we have. And it has this enormous army, and it has these extremely and increasingly sophisticated weapons. Now, what we wouldn't want would be just march in there and do something. Make a country great again. That is not really a wise way to act, because the perils are not just of deliberate action by North Korea and doing what they think will been required for regime and personal survival. But the peril is accident. The peril is mistake. The peril is technology breakdown. These are the dangers that have to be given weight. And the issues, I think it's actually quite a good thing, if I can say so, respectfully, as we lawyers say, that President Trump has ceased really making tweets about North Korea. A little bit of quiet and serious reflection and considering how the steps can be taken consistent with the enormous dangers of a misstep. This is not something just to be rushed into. The point of the meeting last night was very interesting, and I hadn't thought of this before. It related to whether when General MacArthur led the United Nations Army and turned around the battle in the Korean War, he should have stopped at the parallel. He shouldn't have gone further, because this is, it was said, this is what has created the paranoia in North Korea. But on the other hand, it was North Korea that marched into South Korea. They wanted to liberate South Korea, so-called, and they were defeated, and that's no doubt why President Truman said, just keep going.
Question here.
Gillis Bronowski. Regimes such as this in history have always failed at some time or other, not necessarily when there was a United Nations around. What can this regime possibly be hoping to achieve in the long run?
Well,
it seems to me they're going to achieve nothing. And so why the hell they do it? A bit the same as ISIS. I can't imagine what they're going to achieve.
I sometimes wonder, when he rests on his pillow, what does Kim Jong-un think he is trying to do for his people?
Exactly.
Now, the answer that comes back to that question is the answer that many leaders in the Stalinist societies would have said. We are trying to build a better world. We are trying to build a world without oppression of the workers. We're trying to build a better society where there will be true equality and where there won't be the racial and other prejudice that exists in the United States of America and so on. That's what they will say at one level. In their subconscious mind, they might just think of the photograph they have seen of Saddam Hussein coming out of that hole in Baghdad, or of Gaddafi coming out of the pipe in Libya and think to themselves, that is not something we would like to go through. And so whatever they say or whatever is the fact of the matter, there are true believers in North Korea, no doubt about that. They are the elite class who depend for a pretty reasonable life upon circling around and supporting the great leader. But I think one of the most interesting developments in the last year was the defection of the deputy head of mission of North Korea in the Court of St. James in England. He was a top official in DPRK, and he put his pen into a position and folded his papers and put his desk. It was all nice and clean, as diplomats always are. And then he went down and he got onto into a car. He asked to be let out. He wanted to buy something. He got let out and he went straight to a vehicle provided to him by MI6. And he went straight to the airport and he landed in Seoul with his family. They had made a mistake of letting him take his two sons. Now, he will be a source of a lot of information, most up-to-date and most accurate, about the feeling one level down in North Korea. There's never been a general uprising. There have been riots, but they've been about food and the economic situation and the ration system. But these are the issues we have to explore. And we do have a record of Germany here. It's not the same. Indeed, it's very different. But at a certain point, Willy Brandt became the Chancellor. He began the Ostpolitik. He took steps to reach out. That led to more and more connections. And ultimately, but mainly because of the fall of the Berlin Wall, the regime broke down. And Professor Victor Cha, a Korean-born American political scientist, wrote an excellent book on the failed state. And it finishes with this sentence: if in 20 years the Democratic People's Republic is no more, I will not be surprised. If in 20 years the Democratic People's Republic is still in place, I will not be surprised. So we just don't know.
Pushing up the back and then down.
Thank you.
Broke down the ability for the leaders to keep control. But to me, it doesn't seem that there's any way in North Korea. I know one diplomat or one member of the high command defecting. Well, there are plenty of defections in the Eastern Bloc and China. But where will any of the outside get to the inside to try and erode the sort of grip that the supreme leader has over everyone?
Okay, so the suggestion is that the decline of the Stalinist states in the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe had a lot to do with the people there becoming more aware of what was going on outside through Radio Free Europe and like-minded organisations, and likewise in China, where increasingly the Chinese citizens became aware of what of the world outside of China. And the question is, can there be any change in North Korea whilst there's so little awareness to the North Koreans of what's going on outside their own country due to the regime's censorship and dictatorship?
I think it's questionable that there is little awareness in North Korea about what's going on, because extremely popular in North Korea are the soap operas on videos or on DVDs, which have the great merit of showing in the background the life in South Korea, whereas they are told that theirs is the successful economy, the background shows all the white goods, the washing machines and the wonderful cars and the highways and the mode of life, the clothes, the freedom, and that is denied to the people of North Korea. So it is, or at least it has been, extremely perilous to be found with those DVDs in your home. But a lot of people want them against the drab media that they get in North Korea. And as well as that, the American-supported Korean language broadcasts do get into North Korea, and therefore this information is getting in, and the BBC is resuming its service, the Korean language service, in September, I think. I wrote a letter to the then minister in Britain and to the BBC encouraging them to do this, and I'm very glad they've done so, because there's no doubt the BBC has a track record of honesty and strength in these sorts of situations. So a lot is going in, but I've said repeatedly, and the Commission of Inquiry has said, South Korea is one of the most advanced digital economies in the world, if not the most advanced, certainly very advanced. And it should be within their power to get more into North Korea. Merchants who come in from China bring back mobile phones with internet availability in it. Then it's a matter of getting into an area where you can safely get access to it. But all of this is happening. But it can happen as much as it likes. But school children are taken to public squares to watch executions. They came to us, it's reported in the report, and they said, we hated not so much the sight of it, but the blood and the bone that came from the firing squad and spattered all over our uniforms. We hated it. And it's sort of very vivid images like that. I mean, I can write a report, and I've written reports and judgments of courts, and explain things and chronicle them as best I can. But there's nothing like somebody who has actually been there speaking to power. And even if we did nothing else in our inquiry, the fact that we gave the dignity to the people who came to us of giving them an opportunity to tell their story and not cross-examining, giving them an opportunity to tell it in their words. That's why this is such a powerful document, and it's not available easily in North Korea and would be a deathly danger if you were caught with it. But it's really important somehow that we get this into North Korea, so when an opportunity comes, there will be a way whereby the people of North Korea can respond. Because you are right, it is not a natural part of human history that regimes that are so disproportionate and so intemperate and so violent last forever.
We're getting very close to the end, so we've got a question here and we'll see how we go. Yep.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Kirby. We really appreciate very much your mentioning of the abduction issue of the Japanese citizen, which is a very, very serious, as for us, as serious as nuclear development and the missile development matter. And we also appreciate your recent visit to Tokyo in order to receive the Imperial Declaration for your excellent achievement as the chair of the Commission of Inquiry of the United Nations. Thank you very much. And on that occasion, you are very kind enough to meet the family of the abducted victims of the abduction matter, which is a great encouragement for those families who need the encouragement, not only from Japanese domestic, but also the international community. And in that sense, I see that your role as the chair of the COR could be some template for the diplomacy of Australia in the United Nations or multilateral forum. So my question is that we tend to see...
I've got to be brief.
Korea in the nuclear, missile, and human rights in the totality. But as for the human rights, if we take that aspect around, would it be possible to put this matter to the attention of the Security Council apart from the nuclear missile matter? So this might be not a practical issue, but hypothetically, if we slice the matter into some piece, would it be make some difference?
Okay, I think
Security Council.
So just those who didn't pick it up, the suggestion is that in Japan, the issue of the abduction of the Japanese citizens into Korea is just as important issue as North Korea's nuclear capacity. And then other questions about what might happen in relation to this matter at the United Nations.
Well, first of all, I should say that in the work we performed, both the Korean Foreign Ministry and the Japanese Foreign Ministry were most careful to respect the independence of the Commission and were highly professional. And I have to pay a tribute to the way in which they handled the issue. I know that both in Korea and in South Korea and in Japan, the issue of the abductions is a double affront. First of all, it's an affront to the human rights of nationals, but it's also an affront to the sovereignty and the dignity of their own state. And it's one which is very deeply held. I thank you, Consul General, for being here and for the honours that Japan has given. And we rather thought in our minds that that was not for us personally. That was a signal by Japan that it has not given up on the obligations of the Japanese nation and people to recover all of the Japanese nationals who were admittedly seized. This is an omission by Kim Jong-il, seized and taken to North Korea for trivial purposes. What can happen in the Security Council? Nothing will happen so long as one of the five permanent members will vote against action. But so far it hasn't been put to the test. My own feeling will be that, and I expressed this to Ambassador Samantha Power, who was the former ambassador of the United States to the Security Council, a point will be reached, I think, where the scheme of the Charter envisages that it should be put to a vote, that the proposal of the referral of North Korea to the prosecutor of the International Criminal Court, which has the power to send it there, will be put to a vote, so that those who stand against answerability and accountability to history and to the bar of history and to the people who are the victims or who claim they are victims, so that will be on the record. Let those who stand in the way of the working of the Charter in accordance with its principles be identified so that history can judge. Because history will judge. Everything passes in history, and this will pass. But in the meantime, there's a lot of work to be done.
Many thanks, Michael Kirby. I think we'll leave it there. I know there are other questions and comments in the room, but we always finish on time, so we're going to do that again today, and it was a very appropriate point to finish on. Australia plays an important part in the world, always has, and no doubt will continue to do so, and so do our institutions, and so do individual Australians. And without question, the Honourable Michael Kirby's contribution in recent years in this inquiry into human rights in North Korea has been of immense importance to the debate, and sadly it's become more relevant tonight than perhaps it was a week ago, but its relevance will continue. And as someone speaking as a historian to a judge, we're on pretty similar territory here, and as you know, what's very important in all these matters is the record, and what you've done in your report is to put down the record of what happened in the past with a view to looking to improvements or resolution in the future, but at least we have the record of people who are allowed to state their case, South Koreans, North Koreans, Japanese and others who are able to state their case about the regime in North Korea since the 1950s. And so we're delighted that you came to the Institute tonight. It's a very important paper. It'll be on our podcast tomorrow. It'll be published by Anne in due course in the Sydney Papers Online. It's been filmed tonight by Foxtel 648, and it's a very important occasion, and congratulations for all the work you've done, and no doubt you'll come back in the future. But well done tonight.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.